Welcome to the Focus Today podcast with Perry Atkinson.
All right, welcome back, and delighted to have back with us today Mark Miller. Mark is the senior attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, an outstanding organization. They do have a website. It's called pacificlegal.org. There is a picture of their landing page, and they are defenders of liberty and justice for all. So check it out and support them if you feel led to. PacificLegal.org. Mark, thanks for your time. How are you, sir?
Very good. Great to join you, Perry.
Thank you. I want to talk about squatting a little bit. Whoever thought this would be going on in America? How is this being looked at in the legal system, and is this legal? How do we fight this?
Well, it really is amazing, Perry, right? That, you know, I don't think too many of your viewers probably knew what squatting was, or maybe had heard about it in the past, but when they weren't aware that it was becoming a serious issue. And then all of a sudden, like so many different issues, it explodes. And in fact, this idea of squatting what used to be called adverse possession, although what we're seeing today is squatting is not nothing like what we used to call adverse possession. It's been something that's been going on for years. It's the idea that someone can come onto your property that you own free and clear, or you have a mortgage, but you have full rights to it, and they think they can just move in when you're not paying attention and take over and expect the law to treat them as if they're a tenant and force you to spend months or even years, we're seeing in some places like New York City, to get them out.
So, does this fall under the definition of adverse possession?
Well, that's a great question, Perry. You know, because as a textualist or an originalist, which is, you know, how many of us lawyers who sort of emulate Justice Scalia and how he changed the law and how we interpret the law sort of think of ourselves, you know, you hear adverse possession and you think of the common law. The idea being that, particularly out west, there'd be property that was abandoned or there was no clear owner. And you come in and you openly start taking care of the property. And you perhaps even openly go so far as to start paying the property taxes. Then the state law would recognize after a number of years that you have a right to own that property. You'd have to go to court to prove it. That's nothing like what we're seeing today. That was what we used to call adverse possession. And we would sometimes call it squatting. But now what we're seeing is squatting is people move into houses that have just been, perhaps they are snowbird houses in Florida or vacation houses along the coasts, West Coast or East Coast. And they just decide, I'm going to move in when no one's paying attention. And they think they have rights. And in fact, in our blue cities, especially New York, Chicago, L.A., they're getting away with it because the courts are taking months, if not years, to get them out.
Okay, a couple of other terms. Is this breaking and entering? Is this trespassing?
I think that's exactly right. You call it trespassing. Even Joe Rogan calls it stealing. I mean, if you think about property rights, Perry, as you own that piece of property. If they move in and you have the right to live there, aren't they stealing from you? That's what Rogan said. I agree with that. At Pacific Legal, as opposed to stealing, we're calling it trespass. That's really what it is. It's breaking and entering. They have no right to be on your property. And unfortunately, our state courts, particularly in the blue states, I have to give credit to Ron DeSantis, and we can get to that if you'd like to talk about what Florida is doing different. But in our blue states, they are saying that these squatters are like tenants, and they treat you like a landlord, even though you never agreed that they could rent your or lease your property.
So what right does the property owner have? I mean, if you don't have a sign that says no trespassing, and yet they trespass and enter, does the property owner still have a right to take action? And I'm talking outside of the court?
Yes. Yeah, so you're talking like sort of self-help, if you will. And
yeah.
So I'm going to lay out three different approaches we could look at. One, as I alluded to just now, Governor DeSantis has signed one of the strongest anti-squatters rights laws in the country. If you're squatting on a piece of property, and in Florida, we've been seeing this problem for years. It just was sort of under the surface. We were seeing it because of the foreclosure crisis. It wasn't people who were losing their houses in the foreclosure that were squatting. Rather, it was people who were seeing an empty house because whoever had the mortgage had, you know, defaulted, and it was taking the bank time to repossess the house in the courts. And so some third party moved in. And so Florida passed a law just a few weeks ago in the legislature, signed by Governor DeSantis last week, that said if you're squatting and you don't have a notarized lease or some proof that you've been paying rent, you're out, that the homeowner can go right to the police and get you out. And I think that's really where our state courts should go. Secondly, as I said, there were three arguments here. Secondly, you could argue this is an unconstitutional taking. As you know, Perry, at Pacific Legal, we are 17-2 at the U.S. Supreme Court over the last 50 years in fighting for property rights. We usually win when we represent the little guy against the government. We would say that any state laws that allow someone to move on to your property and take it, if you will, without paying you for it and without your approval and your, you know, consent, that's an unconstitutional taking. When the state allows that to happen, the state is effectively enabling the taking of your property. So that would be a second argument, and we're looking for cases like that at Pacific Legal. And third, self-help, as you alluded to. And again, I think states are going to have to take action to make it clearer that if an owner finds that someone has dispossessed them of their property, you know, temporarily, that the homeowner can, you know, take action on their own part to get rid of them and not be risking a lawsuit or even risking being arrested like we've seen in some blue states. If someone moves onto your property, they have no right to be there, you should be able to move them and say, get out, and make sure they're out. And the police shouldn't be arresting you since you own the property.
I think that's where our brain goes on tilt, Mark, because we're seeing some cases now where these squatters may have some unusual right. But you get in some of these rural areas where people will take this on for themselves. And if it ends up with injury or even death, is the homeowner or the property owner in trouble here?
Well, I think, you know, Perry, you're getting at these two concepts that we think about oftentimes in criminal law, but it applies to property law just as much, which is deterrence and consequences. The problem is these people who are squatting on property, who are trespassing, breaking and entering and stealing, they don't think there's going to be consequences. They think they'll be able to live there for months or even years. They also don't think they're deterred from it. They don't think the homeowner will take action that perhaps could make it clear to them that they better skedaddle. So they're not deterred from it. And so if people knew that if they came onto their someone else's property and squatted there, they knew there would be immediate consequences, they'd probably be deterred. And so that's, in fact, I think, Perry, you may be onto something, certainly in the rural states or even states like Florida. I don't want to make an analogy that goes too far, but we have these new sort of new stand your ground laws that say you can use deadly force to protect your private property if someone invades your house while you're there. I'm not saying that anyone should be shooting anyone. I want to be clear. But at the same time, you should be able to stand your ground when it's your property and say, squatter, get out.
Does posting on your property secure your position?
Well, I think that the posting speaks to the issue of how you discourage someone from squatting in the first place. You know, I've told this story to other journalists. You know, when I was young, my grandparents were snowbirds. All their neighbors knew my grandparents went to Florida for the winter from New Jersey, and even the local law enforcement knew. So when they saw something, when the police or the neighbors saw something amiss on their property, my grandparents got a call. So if you make sure your neighbors know that you've gone away or that you put up no trespassing signs, all these things are steps you do to make it clear to the trespasser they should move along. You don't want to make yourself an easy mark. Again, I'm not blaming the victim here, but at the same time, just like a pickpocket in Times Square looks for who's going to be easiest to steal from, you want to make sure you discourage the squatters from moving into your house and they move on to someone else's house.
This deals with the most fundamental right of being an American, your private property. Do you see this rising to some level, national level of a law?
I think for sure. I think you're exactly right when you say, you know, property rights speak to our fundamental rights. Private property rights are the basic underpinning of stable society. We as Americans, we trust that if our, you know, that the government will protect our property rights. And when the government stops protecting them, that's when we start to lose trust in the government and we start to lose trust in each other. And society becomes more dangerous. We're seeing that in some of our blue states where, you know, particularly during the pandemic, when there was these, you know, autonomous zones set up in Seattle, for example, and you could just not go into certain private property or public property where there was private property as well, because the police were not enforcing private property rights. And so, do I think the federal government will get involved? I think first we need to see the states get involved and be more aggressive, and it should be blue states and red states. We should be able to agree at a bipartisan level that private property rights have to be protected, and that squatting is something we're going to make sure is discouraged with consequences, immediate consequences, and deterrence. I can say in Florida, what we watch is we watch the bill go through that Governor DeSantis was behind. Democrats and Republicans voted for the bill. It basically sailed through unanimously. That bipartisan support should be seen in other states as well, Perry.
Let me ask you this, Mark, as it relates to this. We're seeing it now move over into secondary homes. You call them maybe, you know, snowbird homes, things like that. I get all that. But it also now deals with RVs. It could be a motorhome. It could be a travel trailer. It could even be a boat. We're starting to see squatters in these areas. And yet those three areas also can be defined as a second residence based upon certain qualifications. Would they qualify?
Yes, Perry. I would say that regardless of whether we call it a boat or we call it an RV, you know, a moving home, if you will, a mobile home, these are all homes. These are places where people hang their hats, and they should expect law enforcement to protect them, that the law will be put in place to protect their property rights in case. In fact, Perry, there's a famous Supreme Court case from about half a dozen years ago involving someone who had a boat in South Florida. His name was Fane Lozman, and he represented himself. And the argument that his boat was his home and was being taken. And the local government down there in Palm Beach said, no, it's not a home, it's a boat. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, again, bipartisan, unanimously, said, no, a boat can be a home. And so for sure, if a boat can be a home for takings purposes, the government can't just take your home or take your boat, which is what they did to Fane, then, you know, squatters can't take your boat or your mobile home either.
Isn't there even laws and taxation that would help qualify that? I mean, sometimes these boats and homes, as long as they have a kitchen and a restroom, they qualify as a secondary residence or a residence. I mean, doesn't that help?
Yes, Perry, absolutely. Those are the kinds of things we look at to determine how are we going to treat a piece of property for taxation purposes. And you're exactly right. You're hitting the nail on the head that we look at, you know, is there a kitchen? Is there a bed? Is there a bedroom? You know, how does the homeowner or the property owner treat the premises, in this case, the boat or the mobile home?
So, Mark, what's your 30,000-foot view? What's going to happen with this? We're seeing more and more squatters. Some of it's related to an open border. You know the drill. But the bottom line is squatting is seemingly on a rise. Where do you think this is going?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting, Perry, that you relate it to immigration, because ultimately the fact of immigration, whether it's illegal or legal, it's putting more and more people in the United States who need a place to live. And again, this isn't to say they're justified, whether it's immigrants or just someone who can't afford to live elsewhere, they're justified to steal someone's property and move in as a squatter. But it really speaks to a larger problem that's been brewing in our country for 50 years or more, which is we're not building enough housing. And so I think you are seeing, on a bipartisan basis, just like with squatting, I think we're seeing bipartisan objections and opposition to squatting. We're also seeing a bipartisan effort to build more housing, to reduce the price for housing so that people can afford, so our children and our grandchildren can get into that first house, which is really the American dream. And as the prices for housing comes down, as we make it easier to build housing, hopefully this problem will start to go away. Again, whether it's illegal immigrants, legal immigrants, or just Americans who need a place to live.
Absolutely fascinating. Let me take a break. Let me show our viewers and listeners. You can go to Mark's website, pacificlegal.org, where he's the senior attorney there at Pacific Legal Foundation. And we value his time greatly. So thank you, Mark, for your time. Let me just say, go to pacificlegal.org. They're defending your liberty and your justice for all. And support them. We'll be right back.
We'll be back to this week's interview in just a few seconds. In the meantime, we want to let you know that you can watch this interview, plus many more exclusive interviews that happen this week on the Dove's Daily TV and radio show, by visiting our website, thedove.us. And while you're there, sign up for our free daily devotional, The Word for You Today. 3 months of daily readings that will connect you with God's Word. Now, back to the show.
And certainly an honor to have with us today Mark Miller. Mark is the senior attorney there at the Pacific Legal Foundation. And let me say, an outstanding organization defending your liberties and your freedoms. You can go to pacificlegal.org is the website. And if you feel led, certainly support them. They're frontline warriors on your behalf. Mark, thank you for the squatter thing. My head kind of on tilt with this whole thing. It would seem to me that if you're trespassing, you're trespassing. What's the problem here? Fine lines being what it is. Thank you for being on the front line of that. What else is going on at the Supreme Court that's kind of got your interest?
Yeah, Perry, there are any number of, there's sort of, buckets or tranches of different areas of the law that are so interesting right now. Pacific Legal, we work to try and push the Supreme Court, and obviously the justices have their own minds, but we do try at Pacific Legal to move the law in a direction that protects liberty. And that's what we've done for 50 years. As I alluded to earlier, we're 17-2 with the Supreme Court. We have one pending in the property rights area, that would hopefully bring us to 18-2. We will see. We'll find out by the end of June. The cases I find most interesting of those buckets, I would say, is one, we have the Trump bucket. We have an argument later in April. On his the argument he makes that he's immune from lawsuit, from criminal prosecution. I think that will be a very interesting argument that will really be a precedential case that will affect the way presidents can lead our country for time immemorial going forward, just like we remember U.S. versus Nixon or Bush versus Gore. I think that the Trump immunity case, just like that Colorado case, will be important. We also have these administrative law cases. Last week, there was the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case, which was a challenge to the mifepristone, FDA, the abortion pill through the mail case. That's related to other cases, one called Loper Bright and one called Corner Post, that again get at the question of when can we challenge the administrative agencies, the executive branch of the government as citizens. So I think that issue is interesting. You also have the free speech cases. The NRA versus Vulo, where the New York state government was really coming down hard on banks that were trying to get the NRA out of business. And then when the White House was calling up the social media companies and telling them to take down posts, that's another case. So really, free speech, administrative law, Trump, and of course, property rights, as Pacific Legal focuses on. So there's really, a smorgasbord of issues really at the Supreme Court right now.
A couple of those, if you don't mind, let me ask you some additional questions. On the former President Trump's case of immunity while he was president, this is going to be an interesting case. I realize this is highly politicized, but let's say for a moment he loses this case. Does that open the door for previous administrations to be subject to a lawsuit?
Certainly that is, Perry, what one of the arguments President Trump is making. He's tried to compare himself to certain decisions President Reagan made in the 80s, or President Obama made, or President Clinton made when he bombed, an aspirin factory in the wake of the Lewinsky matter. Could he have been sued, Clinton, that is, for decisions he made as president? The counterargument, I think, that could be made, it would be that what President Trump did leading up to January 6th wasn't acting as president. And again, I'm just making out the arguments, not saying what I believe, but he wasn't acting as president in terms of defending the country, if you will, or taking actions that he thought were presidential, but rather President Trump was trying to get himself reelected, trying to make sure that he believed the right processes were followed such that the election fraud he believed had occurred could be remedied in the Congress on January 6th. But again, that wasn't really his role as president, is what the counter-arguers would say. That was his role as trying to get elected, as a politician. So on the one hand, Perry, yes, I think it's fair to say that a big loss for Trump here could potentially trickle down to affect presidents in the past, President Obama, President Clinton, President George W. Bush. But I think the other side would argue, no, it only has to do with actions that are outside your powers as president, at political actions, if you will.
So those arguing against the president are kind of dealing with being a thought policeman, right? I mean, how do you know where that line is drawn when you are a sitting president of the United States?
Well, I think you're getting at, Perry, what is the Supreme Court going to have to wrestle with in the oral argument that's supposed to be in late April? Where do you draw the line? It's exactly right, the language you use. Where do you draw the line between acting as president versus acting as a politician? President Trump's lawyers will argue that in trying to make sure that the processes were filed on January 6th, all he was trying to do, and this is in the briefs, is make sure that we had a fair election. And they would say that that is within his powers as president. I think what you may see the Supreme Court justices wrestle with is the idea that the lower court, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, had issued a fairly broad ruling that the president was simply not immune from criminal prosecution, and they didn't get too deep into the weeds of the facts. And I could see the justices saying, well, sometimes the president can't be immune. Sometimes he can. And you have to have a better understanding of what are the facts in play to make the decision. So I'm not saying the Supreme Court will give him a big win or a big loss, but I do think they may send it back down and say, we want to know more facts here. And then maybe we can start drawing lines and getting into, you know, as you said, getting into his head as to where was he acting politically versus where was he acting presidentially.
I think the other part of this argument, Mark, that's so interesting to me is that there's an assumption that he's guilty of a crime that he hasn't been convicted of. If there was a conviction on the table, then maybe all this would have some teeth to it, but there's no conviction on the table here.
And you're reminding me, Perry, of the Colorado electors case. And that was the same sort of argument there, that he hasn't been found guilty of insurrection. In fact, he hasn't even been charged as an insurrectionist. Even though Jack Smith has challenged him, and that immunity case is about what Jack Smith charged him with, Jack Smith intentionally didn't charge him with the federal crime of insurrection. And so why are we trying to get into his head if we're not actually charging with what we think, at least what Jack Smith probably thinks is going on, which is that this was insurrection? That does speak to sort of the heart of the matter, is why didn't Jack Smith charge him with the underlying crime? In fact, if the Senate had convicted President Trump when he was impeached by Congress of insurrection right as his term finished up and we got right out of his term, perhaps this would all be moot. Although I would argue to you, Perry, that President Trump would probably still be just as popular with the people who want to vote for him, and probably he'd be challenging it and saying he should still get to be president again.
My whole concern here is more on the legal side, that if a precedent is set of somebody being assumed guilty of a crime that they haven't been charged or convicted with, this opens up a can of worms and takes some of the foundation of a judicial system away. You can get me for just being a nice guy and you think I'm a bad guy.
Well, yes, and there we're getting at the idea that there are, and Justice Gorsuch last week in one of the oral arguments mentioned that there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of crimes on the book. And there's the old Russian expression, buy me the man and I will show you the crime. I don't know how you say that in Russian, yeah. But that is a problem of our American justice system, that there are too many laws and it's too easy, if they want to get you, to charge you with a crime.
Yeah. Over to the abortion pill case. Did you listen to the arguments? What did you think of them?
I did. I absolutely did listen to the arguments. And I'll mention, just for full disclosure, I'm on the board of directors of Americans United for Life. My comments here, though, are just as a lawyer who has observed Americans United for Life being one of the longest pro-life organizations at the national level. The country was founded right before Roe. Right. But I thought that the argument was very interesting. I think, as a longtime person who thought Roe was wrongly decided, and I saw that many laws, First Amendment laws especially, were sort of distorted by abortion jurisprudence, I do think that this case is almost the flip side of it, where Mifepristone, the pro-life side, would simply argue that we just don't think you should be able to do an abortion, period. And so the abortion pill is becoming a much more popular way of doing abortion. And so the pro-life side is trying to do whatever it can to make abortion illegal. But whether this is the right vehicle, what we sometimes say at the Supreme Court, whether a case is the right vehicle, I question that. The justices pretty much look to be, other than maybe Justice Alito, not favorable to the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, which was, say, the pro-life side. Mm.
Does this get into malpractice at all? Hippocratic oath? I mean, we deal with that in Oregon. It's called doctor-assisted suicide. I mean, are doctors complicit of a crime here?
Well, Perry, I think that is, in fact, you'd be surprised what I'm about to say, but it's the truth. The lawyer for the abortion pill manufacturer in the case made that very argument to defend the rules that were being challenged by the pro-life doctors in this case. What she said was, look, if the FDA approves this drug and allows this drug to be sent out by mail, which is what's at issue here, and there's malpractice that occurs, not that it will be criminally charged, but rather the victim, the mother, can sue the abortion manufacturer, the abortion pill manufacturer, and or the doctor for malpractice. And so she was saying that that lawyer was saying that we shouldn't be stopping the FDA from approving the pill being mailed out, but rather we should just be recognizing that there's other ways to regulate the pill, which is, for example, that prescription malpractice or medication, you know, doctor's malpractice. It was an interesting argument, and it did seem to find some purchase with the justices. I will note that the lawyer for the government, Liz Prelogar, would argue, and what she'd say is, if there were, if they were to see malpractice lawsuits like that, that there were to be, you know, complications that occurred because of the pill, that the, you know, mothers that took the pill end up in the hospital with an emergency situation, then the FDA would act and probably take the pill back off the market, or at least stop letting it be used by mail order, and instead going back to the way it used to work, which is making doctors see the patient in person.
Staggering. I wish I had more time to talk to you about this, because reports that you're hearing now, the side effects and things going wrong, not to mention the fact that the pills replacing physical abortions, is a staggering number. So thank you, Mark, for your time. Thank you for your work. Thank you for Pacific Legal and all that you do there. I look forward to more visits, but please know you're in our thoughts and prayers. Thanks for being on the front line for us.
Thank you, Perry. Always a pleasure to join you.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you for listening to this week's Focus Today podcast. Remember, you can visit our website to check out all the interviews we did this week on our daily Focus Today TV show at thedove.us. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us and share it with your friends.